This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at the complex relationship between Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the United States as this country sends many more troops into Afghanistan. We'll talk with social activist Tom Hayden and professor of global studies Michael Schwartz about these topics.
We're facing an endless war. Is it really about Al-Qaeda? Or is it about something else? Perhaps U.S. economic interests?
We'll also discuss some recent policy changes in our relationship with the island nation of Cuba.
Does Obama's presidency mean the end of the embargo? Does it mean Cuba will finally be allowed to go back into the Organization of American States? Sal Landau, a Cuban expert, will give us his perspective.
Stay with us. Michael, we've seen so much in the news in the last few weeks related to torture, the memos. Will we ever see any real prosecutions?
You know, Heidi, it's been like a roller coaster. At the center, we are on top of this all the time. We've insisted on criminal liability for what I call the torture program and the torture conspirators. And you've seen Obama moving along in different directions on this. Last week, we talked about the release of the four memos and Obama's statement about not wanting to prosecute the line agents, the people who actually did the torture. I don't think that was a great decision. I don't think, first of all, that it's a political decision and it should be a legal decision. It should be made by Holder or a special prosecutor. I don't like it when the executive decides who can be prosecuted and who shouldn't. That sounds very Bush-like. So we don't like that. The other thing, of course, one fact came out in the last week, which would indicate to me that you want to look more closely at the actual CIA line agents who did the torture. This fact came out, it was leaked by mistake in the memos, they forgot to wipe it out, that 83 waterboarding applications were done to Abu Zubaydah and 183 to, I think it was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Some huge number of waterboardings were done. I don't believe that there's any agent from the CIA who could have possibly believed or thought in good faith that that was legal to do and didn't amount to torture. Impossible. So I don't like that Obama said protect them. I don't like that he protected them under those circumstances. So that was one revelation that last week. It's difficult to think about Obama in this because on one level, I'm very pleased that he released the four memos, these four key memos on interrogation techniques, one by Bybee and three by Stephen Bradbury, which again deeply implicate the Office of Legal Counsel in torture. That was a courageous act. He's actually gotten very criticized for that. And he actually had to make a little trip to the CIA last week where he tried to like give them a big embrace of, I love you, you're doing a great job. And he made a good statement on one level. He said, what we did was contrary to American values. We believe in the rule of law and we can fight Al-Qaeda without going off the deep end here. A strong statement. On the other hand, his opening to the CIA was a little difficult to accept because he tried to ingratiate himself with the CIA, saying, two of your former guys work with me. One works in my National Security Council, and that's, of course, John Brennan, who was second at command at the CIA when the waterboarding was going on and was clearly deeply implicated in it. And the other is a guy named Steve Capps, K-A-P-P-E-S, who is now still at the CIA and was a operational guy at the CIA during the waterboarding. So he has surrounded himself with CIA officials. So I didn't really love what he did at the CIA. And of course, the CIA has a history, not just in the last presidency, but a history of maiming, killing, overthrowing governments that none of us can be very proud of.
But Michael, what has Obama actually said about the issue of prosecuting individuals who were involved?
Well, as we said, as far as the line agents, he said no. And then he made statements over the last week that indicated he didn't favor it. He again repeated the mantra, which I actually can't stand, of we shouldn't move, look backward, we have to go forward, which, as I've said repeatedly, that's just disingenuous because prosecutions are about moving forward and deterrence. So he repeated those statements. His chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, a week ago Sunday, got on a national news program and said the same thing, and then even said, we're not just going to protect the line agents, we're going to protect the lawyers as well. So there was a lot of bad stuff out there. Then all of a sudden, on Tuesday of last week, after he sees King Abdullah II of Jordan, he comes out and he answers some press questions. And one of the questions is about this issue of prosecutions. Now the appropriate person to decide the question of prosecutions is Eric Holder. And Eric Holder has this under consideration, and I shouldn't be making this decision, something like that. And indicating that while the line agents should still not be prosecuted, that those who formulated the policies, that those cases should be looked into by Eric Holder to determine what to do. That is a very strong shift. Let's not mess around. There was a press conference that same day where Robert Gibbs, the press secretary, got hammered on, was this a change in position? Was he disagreeing with what Rahm Emanuel said? Was Rahm right in what he said, et cetera, et cetera? And all Gibbs could keep saying was, just listen to what the president says. Don't listen to what a chief of staff is saying. And so Rahm Emanuel actually then said, essentially, or they issued a statement that he misspoke. So now we have a situation where some part of this prosecution has been referred to Eric Holder. The other part that came out was that he, while not saying he agreed in some kind of congressional committee to investigate this or commission, he did say if you're going to have a congressional committee, it has to be bipartisan with both sides looking at it so it doesn't appear political. Now, as listeners know, I don't favor certainly a truth commission. I wouldn't mind a commission of inquiry that leads to criminal prosecution. But Holder has the ball now on some level and has to be moved forward. The problem with Holder, like the problem with Obama, is that both of them have indicated about this looking forward and not backward. And that's why we at the center have insisted on a special prosecutor. And that's the only way we're going to get it. But we have to say that the 3 months that we at the center and others have taken a position, prosecution, criminal inquiry, that there's been tremendous gains, that we are much farther ahead than we would have ever expected on this. And the right wing is going crazy, which is why it puts us in an interesting situation about criticizing Obama, because, of course, you have to, because he hasn't taken a strong position on this. But the right wing papers are just going after him like he's the devil on releasing these memos. So you have to support him for releasing the memos. Say you want more memos released. You don't want state secrecy, but you also insist on accountability. I mean, that's the only thing you can do here. The final thing on this is the Center for Constitutional Rights, and people can go to our website, ccrjustice.org. We've put together a petition to impeach Jay Bybee, who is a Ninth Circuit federal judge who wrote the key memo that was released by Obama and that implicates him up to his neck in the torture program. It's the actual instructions of how to torture Abu Zubaydah and what you can do and what you can't do. So it lays out the dimensions of the board that you put the person on, that you strap them down to for waterboarding, just 4 feet wide and I think 6 or 7 feet long. It tells you how much you tilt it, how much water you can pour in on the guy, how much time you can do, et cetera. Talks about having a doctor there to make sure you can revive the guy. It's really one of the documents that you would hope never to have read in a country that claims it's a democratic state that adheres to liberty. So there is a petition for going after Bybee. It would be in front of Conyers, and that's where it should be. Conyers has spoken somewhat favorably at this point about going after these guys. So I would urge people to go to that website, ccrjustice.org, and sign that petition. So this is, as I said, it's a roller coaster. You have many contentious forces, the CIA on one hand pushing, right wing, Fox News all the time, programs like 24, the Wall Street Journal, full page editorial today, and an op-ed by one of their editors, again going after Obama on this. But at the same time, what progressives, anyone who cares about accountability and stopping torture in the future, has to insist and hold Obama's feet to the fire on this and Eric Holder's on appointment of a special prosecutor and the prosecution of the torture conspirators. Heidi, not only because you're half Armenian, but because the Armenian genocide, of course, is such a big issue, particularly in Turkey, where even talking about it is suppressed, I wanted to ask you about that and if there's any recent developments. We occasionally bring our listeners up to date on some facts about the Armenian genocide.
Michael, yesterday, April 24th, is the day every year that we commemorate the 1915 killings of over 1.5 million and maybe as many as 2 million Armenians by the Ottoman Turks.
What year was that?
1915, and it went on for about 10 years or so.
And one of your relatives was picked up in that, right, as I recall?
Well, my grandparents were there. My grandmother escaped, having seen her family massacred, and she was literally a mail-order bride brought to this country through Cuba, actually, at the time, after having a difficult teenage few years. But an interesting development, last week, Turkey actually recalled its ambassador to Canada, made him go back to Turkey after he attended an event at which Canada's prime minister spoke at a vigil commemorating the genocide.
That's amazing.
I know.
I mean, all he did, he went to
an event. He didn't say anything himself, as far as I know.
And this is the ambassador from Turkey to Canada?
To Canada, right.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So he's a Turk. He's not an
Armenian.
He's
a Turk, right.
And they called him back. So they're still very sensitive on this issue.
Very sensitive. And the Armenian community in this country was watching during Barack Obama's recent visit to Turkey, hoping he might say something, which he didn't, about the genocide. So that was a disappointment. And we'll continue to monitor progress to pass the bill. So we'll have it in the history books because a lot of the Turkish people and a lot of others actually deny that it took place. We'd like to have it formally recognized. That's all we're asking for.
Last week, President Obama spoke at CIA headquarters, defending his decision to release Bush-era memos that described torture tactics in explicit detail. Our own co-host Michael Ratner was a guest on PBS's NewsHour with host Jim Lehrer, debating Jeffrey Smith, former general counsel of the CIA. Smith is now a partner in a Washington, D.C. law firm. We hear an excerpt from this interview where both guests answer Jim Lehrer's question, "Do you agree with the president's decision not to prosecute any agents who may have committed torture, or what legally constitutes torture, in their previous duties?" Let's have a listen.
The problem here is you have Obama saying we believe in the rule of law, these are important values, that we have to do this even in difficult times, and then you have a set of people who violated the law, or ostensibly violated the law, both as the architects as well as the agents who actually did the waterboarding, etc. And my question really is, going forward, how do you, when another president comes into office, or even this one conceivably, and simply writes a different executive order and says, now we can go back to these techniques, how do you deter torture in the future if you allow impunity for torture in the past? And I don't think Obama's answers to that, I'm looking forward, not backward, are good enough, because I think looking forward is exactly what prosecutions for torture do. They ensure we won't have torture in the future.
Mr. Smith?
Well, prosecutions do not always deter. There are other ways of deterring things. It's very difficult for me to believe that in any conceivable situation in the future that CIA will again be authorized to do these things. But I do not believe that prosecuting officers who acted in good faith within those guidelines is appropriate. The CIA got the message. Everybody in the executive branch got the message. We're not going to do these things going forward. And I don't think there's a realistic concern that prosecuting someone is the way to deter future conduct.
What about Mr. Ratner's point about not only the agents who may have committed these acts, but the architects of those acts themselves?
Well,
what about them?
The president has drawn a line, and I think it's appropriate. The individual officers who carried out these acts will not be prosecuted. He has been silent with respect to others. As we know, the Department of Justice, the Office of Professional Responsibility, is looking at those persons in the Justice Department who wrote those opinions, and I think we need to let that process play out. The Senate Intelligence Committee is also looking at this, so we'll know more over the coming months. I think it's premature to say that those people should be prosecuted or shouldn't be prosecuted. I agree with Mr. Ratner. We need to find out more facts. There's a lot we don't know at this point.
Mr. Ratner, do you believe those folks who wrote the memos, et cetera, not the agents themselves but the others, are legally culpable and should be held criminally responsible?
I have no doubt that the people who wrote the memos, as well as the principals committee, people like Rumsfeld, Tennant, who was head of the CIA, Porter Goss, when all of the torture program occurred, should be criminally investigated. I think the evidence is clear. It's actually screaming at us from the page. When Dick Cheney says, I was one of the people who approved waterboarding, and I would do it again. You realize why you need prosecution for deterrence. There's no issue. And I do want to say that Obama has, while he has not completely precluded prosecution of the architects, he has made statements that make you very, very worried. Statements like we shouldn't seek retribution, that we shouldn't look backward, that we should go forward, that I'm stopping torture. Those kind of statements don't just apply to the agents who did it, but who apply to the upper level people who were the architects.
Mr. Ratner, your use of the word, you said it may not be a deterrence issue. Do you think it's a punishment issue? Now, should these people be punished, whether or not it's a deterrence for future conduct or not?
Look, I'm less concerned about punishment, vengeance, whatever word you want to use, deterrence. I'm concerned, punishment, I'm really concerned about deterrence. I just worry very deeply that another president could simply say, let's do this again. And one of the interesting things when we talk about this, you know, two of the people, and that was one of the disturbing things about Obama's speech, two of the people who he began the speech with.
You mean today, the speech today?
Yes, the speech
CIA.
Today. Yeah. Steve Capps and John Brennan are two people who were at the agency in important roles when the torture program was being carried out by the CIA. And these are people who Obama said he is currently getting advice from. I don't find that reassuring when I think about how is this country going to be torture-free going forward.
Mr. Smith, are you worried about the future for the same reason Mr. Ratner is?
No. First of all, Steve Capps and John Brennan are people I've known a long time. They are terrific public servants, and I don't...
Tell us, remind us what their jobs were and are.
I'm sorry. Steve Capps is now the deputy director of CIA, a long time...
Number two, right under Panetta. Leon Panetta.
That's correct. John Brennan...
Long-time career CIA.
Long-time career, as is John Brennan, who was the head of the National Counterterrorist Center and is now President Obama's Homeland Security Advisor.
Right.
These are two dedicated public servants, and I, for one, am pleased that the President has asked them to stay on. I think it's important to understand that the CIA is asked to do terribly unpleasant things, that we were attacked by Al-Qaeda, and they killed 3,000 American people. And I think what Admiral Blair said in his statement, that looking back...
He's the new head of National Intelligence.
Thank you, yes,
yeah.
The director of National Intelligence.
Right.
Looking back on a clear day in April, it's easy to be critical. I'm very critical of those decisions, and I'm frankly disturbed at what happened. But I don't think it's right to prosecute the people who did it. We need to have an understanding, we need to bear in mind that they did these things to protect the nation. This is not like Nixon and Watergate, where he was trying to protect his own political skin. These were people making decisions to protect the American public. We can be deeply troubled by what happened, as I am, but I think we need to understand that the president and the people around him did it for good purposes.
Mr. Ratner, you don't see the same distinction?
Well, I mean, how can you really see that distinction? If you can break the law and torture people in the name of national security, there's no end to breaking the law. That's the excuse that the Pinochets of the world use in Chile, that torturers everywhere use, that we're doing it for national security. The reason you have the law, as even Obama said, is not for the easy times, it's for the hard times. And the excuse that you did this to protect the American public just doesn't carry any water. In fact, it maybe you can argue something in mitigation, but those guys have to be criminally investigated. Otherwise, all of Obama's words about rule of law are meaningless. If people can, in the high levels of government, can break the law, what kind of example does that send, first to the American people who want to comply with the law, and secondly to nations of the world that say, well, the Americans did this when they had a terrorist attack, why can't we? And then just give people some legal memos and a slap on the wrist at best, if that, and let them off. You just can't have a lawless world, and that's what we have here.
Mr. Smith, do we have a lawless world?
We have a lawless world, and I believe very much that the United States needs to stand up for the rule of law.
We just heard from our own co-host, Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, on a guest appearance on PBS's NewsHour with host Jim Lehrer. The full interview can be heard on our website, lawanddisorder.org. Click on Listening Library. Nearly 15,000 U.S. troops have been recently committed to Afghanistan, and progressive think tanks are pushing the Obama administration to send an additional 17,000, which would bring the total to 70,000 troops. Expansions are being built onto the Bagram prison, as mass incarceration is expected. The war in Afghanistan has escalated. Political and social activist Tom Hayden joins us today to fill in the details and timeline in this escalation of war. Tom is also the author of Ending the War in Iraq. Welcome, Tom, to Law and Disorder.
Hello, Heidi.
Tom, we know you've been following the escalation of war in Afghanistan, and you've been writing about it.
How does it change under Obama? Has it gotten better or worse?
Well, it's a breaking story. I mean, we don't really know. Obama's administration has been slow to give us the supplemental appropriation request after saying they wouldn't do that anymore. So we don't even know what the cost will be. Hopefully Congress will start to play the role it should in getting us straight answers on the cost, how casualties are going to be calculated, how an exit strategy is going to be defined, what metrics are going to be used to get out of there. I'm worried that it could be a gradual escalation and very, very bad and serious consequences, not only in Afghanistan, but in Pakistan.
Yeah, why don't we talk about that, at least in Afghanistan first. Just go through some of the numbers. There's been a recent commitment of additional U.S. troops.
17,000 combat troops and 4,000 in other categories, training and so forth.
That's about 21,000.
Yeah, and the generals, I think, asked for 30. They'll probably get 30. Kilcullen, the guy who supports the Global Phoenix Program and is the chief advisor on counterinsurgency to General David Petraeus, says in testimony last week, 10 to 12 years overall to win the war, 2 years of hard fighting, a couple extra $1 billion a month. So, I mean, I think that they plan to send the troops into southern Afghanistan and to take on the Taliban or whoever the local resistance forces are, weaken them or basically tie them up through the sheer force of the American troops. It'll take a couple of years through the congressional elections, and then they'll look up and see where they are in terms of some kind of negotiating track. So I think people need to buckle their seatbelts for a war and not keep wondering if he really means this. I think he does.
Tom, can you tell us a bit about the Center for American Progress and what role, if any, they had in pushing to escalate this war?
I'm very disappointed in them. They are generally good liberal Democrats. Many of them worked for President Clinton, and they did an outstanding job on the issue of Iraq, being the only, Washington think tank of that kind that called for all the troops out in 1 year, meaning the American combat troops and the advisors, trainers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they pushed hard for that. Now they've come out for a military surge in Afghanistan, as well as more economic aid and all the other diplomatic bells and whistles. But I don't understand that it's become sort of Democratic Party doctrine since 2004 when someone, maybe John Kerry, said Afghanistan is getting it right and Iraq is getting it wrong. In other words, they set up a situation where they could be against Iraq but wound up being for Afghanistan.
So, Tom, you see at this point, just to sort of summarize, we might get up to 70,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan, and we have a very long war in front of us. Would that be roughly accurate?
It might go much higher than 70. This is how these things begin. Obama has narrowed it down to one goal, which any president would have to take seriously, which is, can we prevent Al-Qaeda from getting a base area from which to attack Europe or the United States? And there is no Al-Qaeda base in Afghanistan. They're gone. Because of the war we've already conducted, they're in Pakistan. Does that mean that we have to go into Pakistan? Pakistan's like 150 million people. The more we go into Pakistan with the predators and the drones, the more the population turns totally against us. It could expand, if you take the president at his word, it has to expand into Pakistan.
I want to get a sense from you, is there any opposition building to the escalation? I mean, you've given us a sense of the Democrats, and I understand that it's sort of, you know, a good war versus the bad war in Iraq and Al-Qaeda and all that stuff. But where's the opposition? You're there, and you're doing writing, but beyond that.
I must say the Democrats are not fervent about this. I think they're all fearful that they're making a great mistake. So we have to give it a little time and keep pushing on that front. Where's the opposition? Well, out here in Southern California, I work very closely with Robert Greenwald at Brave New Foundation, and he's just back from Afghanistan, and they have a website called Getting Afghanistan Right, which is a kind of soft anti-war website that draws people into the argument.
Tom, you've written some articles on this. Where can people find them?
You can find them at my archive at Huffington Post or The Nation. You can go to TomHayden.com. They eventually wind up there. If you're interested, you can request to be put on my list. I have quite an interesting list of people from the various cities where I've given talks about my writings or books, and there's a lot of life out there. There's just not much leadership at this point. I think also, if I may, Michael, point out that people are just getting over the success of the Barack Obama campaign and trying to get their legs on firm ground, and the economy has collapsed. All these businessmen running around saying, save us from capitalism. It's almost amusing if it wasn't so tragic.
That's right. You know,
on your issue and my issue, but you've been in the lead on this torture issue. Do you notice how it never seems to stop? It only gets greater, and you might want to tie it to Afghanistan, because the president is creating a Guantanamo at the Bagram prison over there, as I told you last year. It's going to be a war in Afghanistan that is soft on torture. How do I put it?
No, Tom, that's completely right. We actually had one of my former counsel, Tina Foster, on, who represents some Bagram people and won that lawsuit.
Yeah.
But you're bringing up is very, very important.
Yeah, so where's the Human Rights Watch? Where's the ACLU? Where's the human rights community? We really want to spend taxpayer dollars and send American troops to fight in a dirty war that incarcerates, without evidence, tens of thousands of people, many of whom are tortured. That is what's happening and will continue to happen, as far as I can tell, in Afghanistan. I don't pretend to understand why the torture issue has the momentum it does.
You know, I don't either, Tom. That's actually what I was going to ask you. You know, I know we've been on it and everything, but at the same time, it's every day on the front page. I do nothing but back-to-back, you know, work on it, discussion, media. And yet on the war stuff, last 2 days there was some stuff on the Times in Afghanistan. But basically, obviously, the war has always been, since certainly your 30, 40 years and mine, much harder issues than almost anything else in this country.
The torture issue is integral to occupation. You can't have
That's important.
Foreign troops occupying a country on behalf of an unpopular government without locking up a lot of people, torturing some, and violating the human rights of many. And so the human rights community has to decide if the war in Afghanistan is a human rights violation in itself. In the meantime, it is good, whatever the reason, that the media and the institutions and the public are caught up in the torture issue. It's the only aspect of the war that gets this serious level of treatment, no?
I agree, Tom, and I've been amazed, actually, because when we started on this even 3 months ago with prosecutions and all that, people thought, the center, we were out of our minds. And now, of course, it's just moving along very, very rapidly. Tom, I just want to really thank you again, because there's not many people who are really focusing on the war anymore in a deep way. And you're one that has been, you know, consistent for a very, very long time. So thanks a lot, Tom.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. As tensions rise between Pakistan and the United States, President Obama recently mentioned that stability in Afghanistan depends on what will happen in Pakistan. The United States and Pakistan have been allies in their interest to purge Islamic extremism. But the two countries are now embroiled in miscommunication, drone wars, and great mistrust that is centered around a $10 billion military aid fund. Analysts say the Obama administration is asking a lot from a fragile Pakistani government that has been in power now for only a year. We talked today with Michael Schwartz about the current relations amid Pakistan, the United States, and the war in Afghanistan. Michael Schwartz is a professor of sociology and faculty director of the Undergraduate College of Global Studies at Stony Brook University. He has written extensively on popular protest and insurgency, as well as on American business and government dynamics. His books include the recently published War Without End. Welcome, Michael, to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
We've been talking about the escalation of the war in Afghanistan and the relationship between Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the United States. Can you give us your sort of brief overview before we ask more specifics?
I think a good starting place for talking about it is referencing the president's recent speech about the new policy, or as he called it, the new policy that he's developed for Pakistan, Afghanistan, and for the U.S. relationship to them. I think he kind of tells the whole story in there, though. You have to read it. You have to unpack it. You can't just take the emphasis he puts on it and leave it there. But he kind of outlines pretty clearly, I think, what the United States' posture is going to be in that area of the world and what the goals are.
So tell us. I think probably most listeners have not read that speech or even aware of it. I mean, you're deep into this.
Yeah. I do think that people have not read it, and of course the corporate media have not made a point of reading it carefully and actually analyzing what's in it. I would point to one little piece of this speech that I think is highly significant, because he starts by saying a campaign against extremism will not succeed with bullets or bombs alone, and then he launches into his discussion of the peaceful side of the American policy, which I think most people would sort of blandly accept must be the positive side. He says, you know, Al-Qaeda offers the people of Pakistan nothing but destruction. We stand for something different. So today I'm calling upon Congress to pass a bipartisan bill co-sponsored by John Kerry and Richard Lugar that authorizes $1.5 billion in direct support for the Pakistani people every year over the next 5 years, resources that will build schools, roads, hospitals, and strengthen Pakistan's democracy. Then he says, I'm also calling on Congress to pass a bipartisan bill co-sponsored by Maria Cantwell, Chris Van Holden, and Peter Hoekstra, that creates opportunity zones in the border region to develop the economy and bring hope to places plagued by violence. And we will ask our friends and allies to do their part, including at the donors' conference in Tokyo next month. Now, if you take that as a whole, what they're basically saying is that the United States is planning to make Pakistan another outpost of neoliberal globalization. And the key words in there is the opportunity zones, which they're such a wonderful name for these export platforms, in which the idea is to create an opportunity for multinational corporations to invest in a local economy and basically take it over. What they're saying is that they're trying to execute a policy that will allow Pakistan to be brought fully into the economic domination of American capitalism and the globalized version of American capitalism, and asking the rest of the OECD and the global north to be participants in this, as they've been participants in the neoliberalization of other economies. And then I think what you see also is that the military aspect of this is only a part of this much larger program, which is to secure that part, the farthest reaches of what used to be called the Middle East or the Arc of Instability, right, to bring it fully under the thrall of American capitalist globalization. And I think that's what we see in this. And the speech as a whole is filled with this. I mean, it's filled with all sorts of references to the United States being administratively involved in Afghanistan and Pakistan, not just, you know, to... They start with, we have to rid them of Al-Qaeda.
Right, that was my question, because if you would ask me, yeah, I would say, well, isn't this about getting rid of Al-Qaeda. And
right.
I think most Americans think that.
Right. But what he says is, he has a kind of logical linkage that he goes. He says, yes, he actually says that's our only goal, is to stop it from being a haven for terrorists who might attack us. And he says, but in order to pursue that goal, we have to deliver to Afghanistan and Pakistan all sorts of other things. Otherwise, we won't be able to achieve that goal. And what it turns out is what we have to deliver to them is actual American presence in a very profound way. American enterprises, American administrators, American experts, American trainers, right? A kind of colonial presence, right? On the one side, and then on the other side of it, an integration of these countries into the global system. The global system read as the world capitalist system that is headed by the United States capitalists. Even the details contain this. It's like when he talks about the reconstruction in Afghanistan in the speech, he actually indicates that this reconstruction will be done by these modern American corporations that are going to have to come in. He won't trust the Afghan government to do this, to build schools, for example. So he doesn't trust the Afghan government to build schools. It's got to be us that build schools, and it's not even the Army Corps of Engineers. It's private enterprise that's going to build schools. So once you unpack the story, what you see is that we're going to open this country up, we're going to, all of the investment is going to come in, and that will integrate these countries and bring them into, a neoliberal Valhalla. And of course, that same neoliberalization process has occurred in Latin America and Africa and so on. And what we know goes on is yes, there is the extraction of very significant profits by large corporations during this process, and there's also an immiseration process that profoundly increases inequality and creates all manner of problems that these countries try to dig out of, and that Latin American countries like Argentina have now had to, completely take the whole thing and start dismantling.
So let me ask Michael, because, the common thing we hear is, well, there's Al-Qaeda, they were in Afghanistan, they're in the border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and we got to send in these 70,000 troops, if not more, to get rid of Al-Qaeda. I understand the program you're saying, which is the first I've even heard of it, to be honest, having not read the speech. But do we really have to escalate the war? Is it necessary for American security? What's going on?
Well, the trouble is that the economic organization that, let's call it the Taliban, it's not Al-Qaeda, of course, the fact that he focuses, this speech is amazing for its exclusive use of the name Al-Qaeda, and I don't even think he uses the word Taliban once, which is highly symptomatic, right? And it shows us that what he's trying to do is to create this kind of massive boogeyman, right? But if you actually go and look at what's going on in Afghanistan, in the south of Afghanistan, and in the northwestern parts of Pakistan, which is the area of the insurgency, right? You'd better label it Taliban, though it's many different groups that are actually involved in this, but at least the Taliban is a designator that carries some validity towards what these people believe in, right? That group in those areas is going to set up a social system and organization that is very incompatible with the neoliberal vision of the Americans, right? And you can look at their strategy in two ways. You can say, well, if they want to get rid of the Taliban, then they're going to have to get rid of the economic social system that the Taliban is setting up. And what system are they going to put in its place? They're not going to rely on the Pakistanis to set up some social system that might be just as alien to American interests. So you're going to put in the American system, which is neoliberal globalization. So you can see it as a counterinsurgency maneuver. The military part of it is that, of course, they're not going to be able to do this in a peaceful way. They're going to have to conquer the area or get the government of Pakistan to open the area up using its military means, right? And in the Afghanistan side, you obviously have to use American military means because there is no facility on the part of Afghanistan to open this area up. But the permanent solution is the way he makes the argument. He said, look, if we conquer it, it's not going to be a permanent solution because it's still going to be a rebellious area, et cetera, et cetera. The final solution, that might be a fortunate term, the final solution will be if we can economically develop this area. And what economic development means is converting it into a haven for international commerce and international corporations that go in, and they become the organizing system there. So the United States is looking, as it did in Iraq, and if you look at the history of Iraq, it's very explicit there, that they're trying to organize an economic revolution in these two countries.
You have a question about your book, which I want to discuss a bit, A War Without End. When did that book come out?
Last fall.
Give us the thesis of War Without End. It sounds accurate from what I've seen since I've started against the Vietnam War 35 years ago.
The idea of the War Without End is that, and I think we can see it very clearly in these situations that we're talking about, is that the nature of these wars, which are, this might be an unfair way to put it, but they're kind of colonial wars, because the United States seeks to have a real kind of administrative control over these countries, to be able to really have a kind of ongoing presence, hopefully a mainly economic political presence, but necessarily a military presence to support that. And the real goal is for the U.S. to be the hegemon of the Middle East, because that's the source of one of the world's most precious resources and pretty much the only source of the surplus of oil in the world. Everyone else is pretty much using their oil as quickly as they're pumping it. And the Middle East, in the broadest sense, the arc of instability, which really starts over right at the border of China and extends all the way into the oil-bearing areas of Africa. And the United States wants to be effectively the hegemon there and be able to dictate policy. For example, in the Afghanistan situation, one of the reasons why they can't withdraw from this apparently worthless area is that Afghanistan is not a worthless area in a number of ways. And one of the most important ways is it borders on three of the Caspian Sea oil countries. And those oil countries are gravitating rather quickly towards China, and secondarily towards Russia right now in the great, scheme of things. And so having a big presence in Afghanistan and hopefully a powerful government in Afghanistan, the U.S. leaders think that they can put a lot of pressure on the stands and get them to move back into the Western orbit rather than the Chinese orbit. Well, if it doesn't work, then they're well positioned for another war. So the War Without End is actually not the same war over and over again. From these guys' vision, they're going to use the military in order to achieve these political economic goals.
Michael, we're going to urge our listeners to read your book. Right. I had a really quick question, and that was, where does Afghanistan's annual $4 billion poppy crop stand in all of this?
Well, it's peculiar. That's a peculiar thing. I mean, Afghanistan did not grow that many poppies before the U.S. invaded. The Taliban had actually eliminated the poppy agriculture, and they grew a whole bunch of other agriculture, which they've been very successful with over the decades and centuries. Wars have interrupted what otherwise was a very successful agricultural country. But one of the things, one of the ironies of this war is a war that's so disrupted, right, really prevents agriculture from prospering, except poppy agriculture can prosper in a wartime situation because it can be refined at the site of harvest into very, very small, compact items that can be shipped, because you're going to just take the drug out of it before you even start shipping it, and you can actually move this stuff out with camels and with donkeys. And so it can actually is an agriculture that can survive this kind of situation, whereas the broader agriculture that would normally be a part of Afghanistan's economy, a major part of Afghanistan's economy, cannot survive this ongoing war. Ironically, the war itself has driven the agriculturalists in Afghanistan into the poppy crop. It's the only cash crop that they can grow in this circumstance. The best thing for eliminating poppy would be peace.
Michael, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you, and we hope to have you again on Law and Disorder.
Yeah, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, it's a very different and new perspective, and we really appreciate it, Michael, so thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Earlier this year, we spoke with filmmaker and Cuban scholar Sal Landau. Sal has been following Cuba, making films about it for decades. We spoke with him about the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Revolution and what its significance was in January of 2009. Now we want to talk to Sal Landau about the changes, if any, we can expect with regard to U.S.-Cuban relations from the new Obama administration. And in talking about that, I want to discuss as well Obama's recent trip to the Summit of the Americas in Trinidad and Tobago. Sal, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Well, Sal, we wanted to bring you on really to give us a little update on your impressions of what's going on with Obama, Cuba, and the Summit of the Americas. So let's start. What do you think about what Obama has done and said about Cuba so far?
Well, I think that Obama has taken a great step forward and gone back 12 years.
He hasn't gone back to President Carter yet, has he?
No, he's gone back to President Clinton, and in some ways to President Carter. In other words, he's allowed Cuban Americans to travel freely to Cuba, and he has lifted a lot of the restrictions on the remittances. And he's allowing looser travel regulations to prevail as well.
And of course, Carter, which you and I remember well in the late 70s, allowed free travel. Anybody could go. So we haven't gone back to Carter yet, so that was your 12-year point.
Yes, and then he has, of course, demanded that Cuba show some reciprocity. Well, Hillary Clinton has anyway. And my advice to the Cubans is that they should allow all Lebanese Cubans to travel freely to the United States.
My advice was actually that they should embargo the United States and demand the freedom of the people at Guantanamo, those political prisoners being held, and maybe do an exchange.
Or start to swap one for one.
Right, something like that.
What can Cuba really offer other than to, you know, promise to stop punching the United States in the fist with its face? It's not as if, you know, Cuba can lift the embargo on the United States.
I think that's a strong point.
And, I mean, I recall, and no one really asks this question, as they don't really have Iran, what did Cuba do to the United States to merit 50 years of punishment? Because every single Cuban, anti-Cuban, I should say, piece of legislation has been justified with the idea of punishing Castro. And at least in the, you know, the films I've made with the Cuban leader, I have not noticed that he has missed either a meal or a conjugal opportunity. So I'm not sure he's received a lot of punishment. I mean, maybe the Cuban Five, these people who are sitting in prison for 10 years, are sort of symbolically getting what was intended for him.
These were steps that were taken. People, you know, compared to what we had in the last 8 years, I guess people welcomed them. But do you see any hopes on the horizon for, you know, at least incrementally getting, doing better, lifting the travel embargo, doing more?
I think very little will happen in the near future. That's my feeling, that it will be now very gradual. And I'm not sure, you know, I think the Cubans may be down on the island, maybe sort of happy with what they're getting. That is, there will be a big inflow of cash coming in with the Cuban Americans. And from the Cubans who travel to Florida to visit their relatives, they'll come back with some cash. And there'll be more contact with Americans, and they'll be spending some cash. But I don't think that Cubans are prepared to have 100,000 spring breakers descend upon Havana.
I would agree with that.
They don't have the room for it in their hotels.
Yes. Well, I mean, even if they did, I mean, they're sort of like not structurally prepared for such an onslaught. Nor are they prepared, I think, yet to have American investors, and I put that in quotation marks, descend upon them with big wads of cash in their hand, trying to buy up everybody and everything that they see. I think, therefore, the gradual approach might very well fit what the Cubans need is. And the difference between now and previous times is that you really do have strong lobbying for the lifting of the embargo. But, you know, not on the part of necessarily progressive people or well-intentioned people. You have the firm business, from agribusiness, from the giant pharmaceuticals, from the huge tourist companies. These are the people who are pressing. You know, and I think the Cubans are aware of that. There's been much hype over the telecommunications bonanza that awaits American companies.
Didn't he lift something about telecommunications?
He did. But I think, you know, there's some short memory here. As I recall, U.S. telecommunications companies owed Cuba almost $100 million and haven't paid them from the days of the 90s after the Helms-Burton bill was put into effect. So I don't think the Cubans necessarily have forgotten that debt.
Right. So now can you relate this a little bit to the Summit of the Americas? Particularly, I guess the first issue is membership in the Organization of American States and remind our listeners that Cuba is not, and when it didn't become a member of the OAS?
Yes, the OAS, at U.S. prodding, kicked Cuba out in 1962 because it wasn't democratic. I mean, at that time, Papa Doc was running Haiti. I mean, there were dictatorships throughout the hemisphere. And, you know, subsequently, a U.S.-backed coup in Brazil brought a military dictatorship in. I don't think anybody tried to kick Brazil out. Then you had Pinochet, the Argentine dictators, an Uruguayan military dictatorship, all of the Central Americans. None of them were ever kicked out, nor did anybody try to kick them out. So Cuba was special because Cuba committed the sin of sins. When you ask, what did Cuba do to the United States? And people say, well, it's a single-party communist government, doesn't allow free elections. And you say, well, wait a minute. Chinese killed thousands of Americans in Korea, and the Vietnamese killed thousands in Vietnam. Both of those countries are led by single-party communist governments. So what did Cuba do that was so terrible? And the answer is disobedience. I mean, that's it. Yeah. Cuba dared for the first time, and very successfully, because it's 50 years now, to resist the United States' attempt to say, we are the boss here, and nobody acts without our permission. The Cubans acted without permission and have gotten away with it, albeit they've been punished. Not the leaders, but the people have been punished for 50 years.
So now the OAS, they've been out of the OAS since, what, 62, you said?
Yeah, now the OAS, it's important to remember what the OAS was all about. In the beginning of the Cold War, when there were negotiations about who gets seats in the UN, and the Soviet Union demanded a seat for every one of the republics, so-called, autonomous republics, the United States countered saying, well, if you're going to have seats, then we will have to seat Latin America, because at that time, many people didn't want to seat the Latin American nations. And so the Rio Treaty established United States military control over the lower part of the hemisphere, and then the OAS was created essentially to maintain political control. And that was the reason it was created. And until the Cuban Revolution, I don't think there was a single vote by any Latin American country against the United States in either the OAS or the UN. I think that's an important piece of history.
But there does seem to be sentiment now for having Cuba come back into the OAS. Is that right?
Well, everybody wants Cuba to come back except the United States. I'm not sure Cuba wants to come in because Cuba says, well, what the hell has the OAS ever done for anybody? And there's a very stunning silence when that question is posed.
The shaking hands with Chavez and Venezuela and sort of Obama's really, but even more than the shaking hands, and not only his being given the book, Open Veins of Latin America, but Obama's statement, yes, we've done wrong in the past, we've intervened, we're not going to do that as much. What do you make of all that?
Well, I think Obama is one of the brightest, cleverest, most winsome of all people that I can ever imagine. He's a hard man to resist. But you have to get a little bit behind his optimistic rhetoric, his humility, his smile, and his handshake. And remember that prize fighters also shake hands before the first round.
As do tennis players and football players. And
yes, and then they go and beat the hell out of each other. If you look, Obama said one thing, and then after the famous photograph now with Chavez and Obama shaking hands, Jeffrey Davidoff, the U.S. rep to the OAS, said, well, wait a minute. The only reason Chavez wanted that is because Obama is more popular in Venezuela than he is.
I love that statement.
And now, Davidoff, of course, would know because he's an old expert on Latin America. I recall even, Michael, that he was in the U.S. Embassy in Santiago, Chile.
Wow.
Back in September of 1973, at the time when Augusto Pinochet, that great Democrat, everybody remembers him, led the military coup that overthrew an actually freely and fairly elected government of Salvador Allende. And at that time, Mr. Davidoff was running wildly around trying to mobilize support for the great Democrat Pinochet. And his cables reflect it. And the cables of all the other members of the embassy reflect that they were doing all they could to support a bloody military dictatorship.
So any last words for us on Cuba? What can we look for? Any hopes for better opening there?
Cuba will have a lower profile, I think, in the near future. I think we've seen, you know, the most publicity we're going to see on it for quite a while now. I don't really expect any very rapid, dramatic change. I think things are a little bit better. They will be a little quieter and less hostile. I think Cuba has its own problems that it really has to deal with that are very serious. I mean, the damage to its economy from those three hurricanes last year.
Right, it's in the billions and billions of dollars, I think.
Yes, and, you know, there's a lot of dissatisfaction in Cuba over the bad economy and the work problems and so on that the government's going to have to take care of. But it does have the stability factor in its favor, in that I think people ought to remember when they talk about Cuba that the brilliance of Fidel Castro, or part of his brilliance, was to export all of his enemies. They're all in Florida where they cause us trouble. And, you know, when he did so, he somehow obsessed them so that all they can think about is hating him or trying to do violence there. You know, and when he was in real trouble, he figured out how to take their money. It's called remittances.
Well, Sal, we want to really thank you again for giving us this update. And actually, what was interesting to me was gives us a little more perspective, not in a negative way, but just in a more realistic way than I think a lot of us had about the combination of Obama lifting restrictions as well as going to the Summit of the Americas. And I think it's a good word of caution.
So, yes, I think he's appointed some very good people in environment and HUD and in labor, and certainly some really good people in the White House staff. In very small areas, he hasn't appointed very good people, you know, like foreign policy, national security, and economics.
Hey, is there a person for Latin American yet? An appointee?
You mean an assistant secretary?
Yes.
No, but the rumor is that it's Arturo Valenzuela, who is a Chilean-American sort of Christian Democrat who wrote a book saying that Allende's problem is he didn't compromise.
My, my. Well, that doesn't sound great. Thank you, Sal.
Thank
we
you.
Really appreciate your coming with us.
Thank
again.
You for having
okay,
me.
Okay, bye-bye.
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 If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.